Hey, it's Mark and John from Dirty Honey, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Charlie Starr from Blackberry Smoke, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
This is Philip H. Anselmo, and you are definitely listening to Iron City Rocks. Damn on.
All right, Pittsburgh! You are the best! You got the best!
Hello and welcome to episode 551 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 551, if you're a fan of the show, a regular listener, a man who needs no introduction, Mr. Damian Darlington, the musical director of Brit Floyd. Brit Floyd will be launching their 2025 tour in our area, starting on April 10th at the First Summit Arena in Johnstown, then doing two shows, the 11th and the 12th at the Benedum Center in Pittsburgh, and for all extents and purposes, a stone's throw away on the 13th at Akron, Ohio. So four shows, depending on exactly where you live in Western Pennsylvania, that are all very easy to get to. So awesome to have a chance to talk to him about 50 years of Wish You Were Here, and how Brit Floyd plans to celebrate that. Then also joining us on the show, we have Mr. Chris Kane, blues extraordinaire, guitarist, a really, really cool songwriter, an amazing singer. He's going to be doing a show at the Thunderbird, so we'll talk to him in a little bit. And finally, we will talk to Mr. Corey Marks, a fabulous kind of crossover, dare I say, hard rock, heavy metal slash country artist, will be coming in to do a show also in April. So before we get too much deeper into that, we're going to talk to Mr. Damian Darlington, play a little Brit Floyd to get you in the mood, and we will talk to Damian.
Attraction is holding me fast. How?
volcano, a vapor trail in the empty air. Above the clouds I see my shadow fly. Out of the corner of my world's a big eye. Dream my breath of morning night. Could blow this sunlight through the roof of the night. There's no sensation to compare with this. Suspended animation, a state of bliss. Can't keep my mind from the circling skies. Tongue tied and twisted, just an earthbound mystic eye.
Ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome back to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line Damien Darlington, musical director of Brit Floyd. How are you doing today, Damien?
I'm doing very well. It's good to be with you here today.
It's a pleasure to speak with you again. You guys are, once again, almost like clockwork. There's snow on the ground here in western Pennsylvania, and tickets are on sale for your series of shows coming in April this year. You're doing a show in Johnstown on the 10th. That's a Thursday night. I believe that's the kickoff of the North American leg of the tour. And then two nights again at the Benenum Center here in Pittsburgh to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Wish You Were Here. When you approach an album like this, I mean, these are all songs that I think at this point I've seen you play all of them, except maybe the reprise of Shine On Crazy Diamond. Do you kind of have to work these differently or decide where in the show you actually kind of put the album? Because your show is much longer than just the album. So what kind of consideration goes in when you approach it as the entire thing as an entity?
Well, you know, certainly you have to make a decision whether you're going to play the album from beginning to end as one piece within the set list or whether you're going to sort of spread it across the whole show. Mm-hmm. And we've decided to actually do the album in one hit, as it were, later on in the show. And of course, yes, the album's about 45 minutes long in total, so there's a lot more to do besides just the Wish You Were Here album. But that is certainly the focal point of this year's tour, celebrating the 50th anniversary of it. And you're kind of correct when it comes to Shine On parts 6 to 9. We've done sort of like Shine On parts 6 to 7 a few times in recent years, but not done the whole thing to the very end in a very long time. So that will be new for us to do the entire Shine On parts 6 to 9.
Yeah, I seem to remember like Have a Cigar being in, you know, either one of the DVDs or the many live performances I've seen. So I was like, I think they've actually hit most, if not all, of this album. I mean, it was such a, you know, when you look at them as entity, well, as really a collection of singles, Wish You Were Here might be kind of at the forefront of, you know, songs that everyone recognizes every song. You know, there's some things on, you know, obviously The Wall that you don't hear on terrestrial radio. There are things even on Dark Side of the Moon that unless you digest the entire album, you may not hear. But Wish You Were Here really is kind of a, almost like a greatest hits album in and of itself. It was such a landmark.
Certainly, I mean, if somebody came along to see at one of our concerts, and they didn't get to sing "Shine on You Crazy Diamond" at some point in the show. I imagine they'd be pretty disappointed, you know. So that's one of Pink Floyd's biggest hooks, if you want to look at it in those terms.
Yeah, I mean, shy of teachers, leave those kids alone. It is kind of a, you know, their tagline. When you do this album, you know, one of the things I think everybody walks away from your show thinking is, you know, the musicianship and the production is so true to the original. When you look at these songs, do you go back? I know from time to time you guys will do maybe a live sort of version. You know, this one maybe came from Pulse or Delicate Sound of Thunder. When you're doing this as an album, do you try to stay true to the album versions of these songs?
For the most part, the one exception is "Welcome to the Machine." We kind of like the sort of some of the more recent versions of it. You know, Pink Floyd's sort of post Roger Waters, when they toured in 1987-88 on the Mumford Lapse of Reason tour, they did a version of "Welcome to the Machine" then, which sort of introduced more of a sort of steady drum pattern into it. And then later on, Roger Waters did a version where he had the female backing vocals were sort of featured quite strongly in it. And it just seems to make a more powerful version of it that we kind of like when it comes to performing it live. So I would say that's the one exception. Everything else is pretty true to the original album then.
Do you go, like, do you approach the visuals to this differently than you would, you know, obviously a lot of these songs would have been in even last year's set. Do you go back and kind of retool the visuals, or is it just kind of, okay, that's the sequence they're going in? I mean, I realize, you know, the animation stuff's got to be really expensive to put together.
It's certainly time consuming. It's a lot of work to do animation, but yeah, for many years we used a video for Shine On, an animated video, and yeah, it was very good. But you know, I kind of felt that it was time to sort of update that a little bit, you know. So we never sort of stand still with the show. We're always trying to improve it wherever we can. So yeah, there will be some different imagery that people haven't seen us use before when they've seen us perform these songs in the past.
I see you're doing, and obviously not in Pittsburgh, but you're doing some shows with Alan Parsons later on this summer. Does that, I find that very interesting to see a band, you know, that is, you know, known as a tribute band performing with, you know, an artist of that level and doing tours together. Is it, this is almost, I was trying to think if I'd ever seen this before. You see tribute bands touring with other tribute bands, and you guys have really reached, I think, the apex of what any tribute band is doing. But to tour with someone of the statue of Alan Parsons, was that how did that kind of come together?
Alan Parsons for some years now, was when he's toured live, has had a singer called PJ Olson performing with him, singing some of the tracks with him, and we sort of met PJ, and he came along and he guested on some of our shows over the last couple of years, and it's kind of through that, and also our manager's previous relationship with Alan Parsons. You know, he's met him a few times, and that's where the germ of this idea came from. And Alan Parsons came out to see one of our shows at the end of 2023, when we just finished off touring our 50th anniversary of the Dark Side of the Moon album, and he came along to a show in California, and he had a very, very good time, and obviously was suitably impressed by the show. And it's through all these sort of things that this has come about, that we're going to be working alongside him later on in some shows in California and Nevada in July. They'll all be taking place in July.
Yeah, it'd be a fantastic sight to see. Question I had for you, this might seem kind of odd, but late last year, David Gilmour released a new solo album. What is that experience like when you put that record on? I mean, you and Edo essentially make a living, you know, playing the music of, you know, and the vocals of what he did. What's the experience like when you get new music from him? And maybe this, I'm trying to think when On an Island came out, if you were doing this, I mean, I guess you would have been even with the Australian at that point. Yeah. What is that experience like for you as a fan to listen to that new music? Do you kind of look at it with a more critical, or what's he doing differently now? Are there little tidbits I can pick up?
I think I think given the nature of what I do, with the fact that I'm a musician and a musician who's specialised in doing his best to recreate David Gilmour, his guitar work and to a certain degree his vocal work over the years, it's inevitable that I kind of look at things with a critical eye. But yeah. I can still just simply be a fan and just be happy that the guy is still producing music, and such great music as well. Yeah. You know, it's amazing to see. So it's a pleasure getting to listen to something new from David Gilmour. It will never not be the case, I think.
Yeah. I think sometimes as a fan, there are artists that you, quite frankly, I know from my own experience, you know, a new album might come out from, you know, a legacy artist. I'm a little skeptical to even listen to it because I don't want it to taint, you know, the relationship I have with their previous music. But with David Gilmour, his music is such a high level, and you know, his work with Polly has been amazing. Somewhat, I think, unfairly criticized by some, but... do you kind of go through it and maybe take some notes? Like, here's some things he's doing a little bit different that, you know, I can incorporate into what I'm doing.
I kind of touched on it before when referring to our version of Welcome to the Machine and like more recent Roger Waters solo version. So yeah, we're definitely always looking at what those guys are doing still when they go off on tour, you know, to get inspiration for things that we should do in our show, whether it be which version, which arrangement of the song we might do, or also the visual kind of things they're doing as well. You know, when it comes to the lights, lasers and video, you know, we'll get ideas wherever we can to incorporate it into our show, things that are appropriate when, you know, doing Pink Floyd, and obviously they're doing things that are appropriate still when it comes to this kind of music.
Can you talk just a little bit? I think, if I'm not mistaken, Edo may have made his debut in Pittsburgh with the band, or if not, it was very close to that. And I've kind of watched you guys over the years, the division of labor actually somewhat change. Was watching the Pulse video on PBS just the other day, and you notice him singing more and doing some leads that I think you may have done in the past. Is that just a trust thing, or is it, you know, you guys have been playing together now, it's been a long time, and as many shows as you do, is it just confidence in what he can do to you can kind of relinquish control over some of that?
I think it's just I'm the musical director. Ultimately, I'm the one who sort of gets to make those decisions about who plays which parts. And, you know, when it comes to Edo, he started playing with us originally in 2015. And so we're already like almost 10 years into him being in the band. And he's just sort of, he's come on in leaps and bounds as a performer in that time. And it became apparent. I always knew he had, like, when it came to vocals, for example, I always knew he had quite a Gilmour-esque kind of voice. And it's just gone to the point where, well, he's ready to sort of take on some of those lead vocal duties. And it's not that anything was that wrong in the past, but if something could be made just that little bit different, then we'll a little bit better, and we can improve it in some way, then we will do that. And when it comes to guitar parts, again, it's just... you know, we both strive to recreate David Gilmour, but nonetheless, we're still slightly different players, and one player might be more suited to a particular guitar solo than another. It's just, and it's down to me to make that judgment, really. And it's not about egos, you know. I don't want to be, you know, it's not that I'm the lead guitarist and I have to do that, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's about what's going to make the band sound the best it possibly can.
With what you guys went through in COVID, I mean, do you guys get kind of to the point as musicians, the two of you, where you kind of know all the parts just in case, you know, perhaps, you know, you take ill or he takes ill, that the show can kind of go on, almost like a, you know, you're ready kind of to step into the other parts?
To a certain degree, certainly in the context of COVID, we had to sort of think more in those terms than we'd done so before, because it was, you know, we were off the road for 18 months before we could play a show again. And even then we only got to play for about 6 weeks in the US. So we had to have these sort of contingency plans in place for if somebody got COVID, who would replace them? Who would step into their shoes? And it was kind of like, there was somebody who could step into Edo's shoes and Edo could step into my shoes if necessary. You know, there were things like that we sort of had in place.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting dynamic, because you look at, you know, kind of guitar duos through the years. You know, you think of, you know, the guys, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, Lynyrd Skynyrd, you know, as a fan, you kind of listen to it, okay, and you start to learn stylistically who's who, even if you can't see it, you know, oh, that's Glenn Tipton or that's KK or whatever. But it's kind of interesting with the two of you striving to be so true to David's music that it makes for an interesting dynamic if you kind of close your eyes and imagine who's playing. I was listening to when you guys were doing Comfortably Numb, and like, if I close my eyes, I'm not sure that I can distinguish who's playing what. And even vocally, I mean, you guys, you know, I don't want to say it's interchangeable because there's certainly a different texture to his voice than yours. But, you know, it really makes a neat addition to have sort of a third color to paint with vocally. You know, obviously Ian seems to do most of the Roger Waters stuff, but it's neat to hear the two of you blend on David's vocals. So it really should be a fantastic performance again. In addition to Wish You Were Here, are you guys digging out any other sort of oddities, or is this, you know, kind of filling it in with the essentials that you have to do, you know, brick in the wall?
Yeah, I mean, there'll always be the essentials there. I mean, you know, that people, on the whole, people who come along to our concerts, there's a certain number of songs they expect to hear, and we're always going to do, you know, Comfortably Numb and certain tracks off Dark Side of the Moon and something off Animals, usually. But outside of that, we're always trying to sort of change things up every year, and you know, occasionally do something completely new that we've never done before, or at the very least bring tracks back into the set that we haven't done for some years, and that's very much the case this time around. You know, we've got tracks we haven't done in 10 years, you know, appearing in the set list this time, and there's certainly at least one track there that we've never performed before as well.
Are there particular songs for the Syd Barrett era that you think really, you know, kind of pop, like Arnold Lane or songs that, you know, of that era that fans kind of clamor for? I mean, obviously, the, you know, the David Gilmour stuff produced, you know, the 30, 40 million selling albums. But, you know, some of that Syd Barrett stuff is so different and so coveted, I think, by fans. Do you get a lot of, you know, fans kind of clamoring for particular tracks from that era?
I think the important thing to sort of way to think about Syd Barrett is he's vital when it comes to Pink Floyd existing in the first place. You know, mm-hmm. Syd Barrett was vital to that. You know, and you know, so without Syd, there'd be no Pink Floyd. So you have to be conscious of that fact when you're doing what we do. But by the same token, it's not to every Pink Floyd fan's taste, some sure. of the early stuff. So it's important to represent it, but you know, perhaps not go that deep into some of it. I mean, it was interesting to see that Nick Mason, you know, when he decided to sort of start touring again, that he mm-hmm. chose to give himself that niche, which I think was very, very clever. Otherwise, he would just go out and do what David Gilmour does or Roger Waters does. And he made a virtue of playing that early stuff, you know, material that was pre-Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah.
But on the whole, when it comes to our show, it also, some of it, the Syd Barrett stuff, I don't think it necessarily lends itself to like an arena or large hall environment in quite the same way that you know, something from the Division Bell album or the Wall would does, you know, when it comes to the production as well. But you know, we will do Arnold Lane, we will do See Emily Play, Astronomy Domini, Lucifer Sam, I've done that one before now, you know, so there's certainly tracks that we do occasionally from that period.
Yeah, I think what you speak of is so true, because I think a lot of fans, you know, that discovered Dark Side of the Moon or whatever, you know, as a teenager, went back and were like, oh, hey, what's this Piper's at the Gates of Dawn? And you put it on and you're like, it's a totally different taste to it. It's very acquired, but I mean, it does have such vital songs on it. And I think the more you listen to it, the more it grows on you. But it you're absolutely right about kind of the scale of that kind of music. You know, it themes, you know, when I listen to it, you could see this being done in a club. Yeah. And I'm sure there's probably 10 Pink Floyd tribute bands out there that are just doing Piper's at the Gates of Dawn. It would not shock me whatsoever with the proliferation of people doing that kind of stuff. So let them do that. Like, let Nick do the saucer stuff and you guys do what you do so well. So we will look forward to seeing you guys again. You're in Johnstown on April 10th. That's a Thursday night. And then two shows at the Benedum Center here in Pittsburgh, the 11th and the 12th. Tickets still available, but anybody who's seen you before knows that they will sell out. Those are always very well attended shows. Pittsburgh seems to loves the Pink Floyd and loves Brit Floyd so much. So I want to thank you, Damien, and we will see you in just outside 2 months, man.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks very much. Been good talking to you.
All right, again, April 11th and 12th here in Pittsburgh for two shows at the Benedum Center. You can catch them on the 10th in Johnstown, the 13th in Akron. You can visit BritFloyd.com, get all the information on all the tour dates if you're not in one of those immediate areas. We're going to turn our attention now to a great, great blues artist on Alligator Records who is fresh off a really, really cool album called Good Intentions Gone Bad. We have Mr. Chris Kane joining us in just a second to talk about a show he's going to be doing at the Thunderbird Cafe and Music Hall on April 13th. So, we don't cross you up. You can check out Brit Floyd on the 11th or the 12th. Get over to see Chris on the 13th at the Thunderbird for a show. So we're going to play you a little bit of Good Intentions Gone Bad, the album, and then we're going to get into that interview with Chris Kane.
When I was a little boy, my father showed to me a little brown guitar that he bought back in 53. I was maybe 8 or 9 and curious as a child could be. He took it out of the case and this is what he said to me. You can play it when you're feeling happy. You can play it when you're feeling sad. Always remember to play a little blues for your dad. That little brown guitar and I soon became the best of friends. And together we traveled a road full of many twists and bends. He's been gone for so many years now, I think about him every day. And now I got a band of my own, 'cause Papa set me on my way. Some days we play for thousands of people. Some nights we play for the tables and chairs. But we always remember to play a little blues for my dad. Stand before the pearly gates. So when St. Peter comes out to judge me, this is what I hope he'll say. Can you live the life of sin? I really shouldn't let you in, but I guess you can't be all that bad. You always remember to play a little blues for your dad. I'll always remember to play a little blues for my dad.
pleasure to welcome Iron City Rocks. We have on the line contemporary blues man Chris Kane. How are you doing today, Chris?
Excellent, thank you.
My pleasure to have a chance to talk to you. I have in my hand a copy of Good Intentions Gone Bad, which came out, it's hard to believe it's been, what, 8-9 months now since the release of the album. Can you talk a little bit, when I listened to this album, I have to admit one of the first things I thought is, you know, you're relatively young to have a voice like that, because I'm listening to this and I'm thinking this guy kind of harkens me back to almost Albert King's tone in his voice. But can you talk a little bit about the collection of songs? So really, you know, for a blues album, you write all of your own material, which is honestly quite unique for blues records. Usually there's 2, 3, 4, 5 covers in an album with a lot of guys.
Wow. I just have always written stuff, and I'm happy that you like them, because I never really know when I'm writing them what, you know, other people would think, but I just write what I'm thinking of at the time. But really makes me feel good to know that when other people listen to it, they like it, you know?
Yeah, I love some of the lyrics, I think especially because it's got a nice blend of subjects you expect in blues songs, but you throw in some modern twists, you know, to make it still feel contemporary.
That's good to hear. You know what I mean? Because I don't really, I'm just going by what I feel and see mostly, you know, in my life, really. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you write songs, do you kind of just keep like some ideas, you know, in a little notebook or in your phone, or do you kind of write, like when you sat down to put this album together in particular, did you sit down and say, okay, it's, you know, April 1st, I'm going to start writing an album today, let's go blank canvas, or do you kind of accumulate ideas along the way?
It's both of those, because I might get ideas when I'm not working on a record or something that I think, well, that's kind of like the germ of some kind of a thing here. So I'll put that in a little book or something, and then I'll have maybe accumulated some of that through time. And then when the opportunity to make a record comes up, I'll look at those and get them out and see if they're like, if they are tunes or if they're just still just a germ of whatever. But I will, if I get any kind of thing that's substantial, so that it's not a tune, but it's could be a tune. Then I will, you know, put it in somewhere until I get more information about it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do those things kind of come to you? Like some guys can sit and work at a song almost like a blacksmith and bang away until they come up with something. Or some guys, it's the bolt of lightning effect. Do you tend
mine's
to find
more of the bolt? Mine's more of the bolt, really, than like hammering it out. I mean, sometimes I've tried to hammer out some things because I thought this really has more value than other ideas that I've had. There's more stuff in this thing, but could never really get past the initial, you know, investigation of the idea. Maybe got a couple of verses down or something, and then like with the song about my father's guitar, I had written that stuff years ago when my father was still alive. I was writing that tune, and what happened was I couldn't find all my demo discs, so I just took the whole machine to his house. And when I was looking for the tunes, he goes, "Wait, what's that thing?" I go, no, that's not a that's from a long time ago. That's a thing." He's like, no, let me hear that. You know what I mean? And he just went crazy. And then, you know, I fought and kicked. Not that, you know, like, this isn't a tune. This is something I tried. I couldn't finish it, you know? And he finished it up and made it this beautiful thing. I mean, I fought and kicked the whole time. I said, "You're going to get me thrown off this label, because this is not, you know." And, you know, I've had more people come to me and say they were in tears when they heard this thing, you know?
Yeah. I think it's certainly a subject that, unfortunately, so many of us, you know, you live long enough, everyone can identify to it. You know, it's one of those themes.
It really made me feel so just You know, I mean, if it was, it would have been up to me, that thing would have never been heard by anybody, because I just thought it wasn't a tune. You know, I was like trying to do something. But Kid Anderson really has done things in my writing, a whole history. I've had more great experiences trying to put my idea into a box that somebody could listen to with him than I have with anybody in my life. I mean, really has that has been the extra juice on that thing, is the fact that, you know, normally I would like kill an idea before it really came to the total vision sometimes, because I think, no, this is not an idea. This is something I'm on the wrong, you know. And so, you know, there's been times when I pulled the plug on some things. It could have been another tune that, you know, I just thought that it wasn't there, you know. I mean, I'm not, I just go with my basic instincts and my feelings when I do this. You know, I try not to shut it down before it's had a chance to see what it is. But on that particular thing, I felt it was just so personal, and you know, I didn't have the whole thing fleshed out, that, you know, I just felt it was, you know, the time was ticking and it wasn't. But I mean, it turns out to be, you know, I mean, I get tears in my eyes every time I hear that thing sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel very proud that it's out there. But I mean, I was fighting against that thing, because I just thought, that's not, you know, they're going to think I'm trying to be Kenny Loggins or something. Not that that's a bad thing. You know what I mean? But just that, you know, and so that of all the tunes in this particular group of tunes that this record is one of the things that, I mean, he made a video that went with it, you know, that like had pictures of my mom and dad in there and stuff. And it was heavy, man. I mean, you know, I never looked at some part of my life like that before. And he just has a gift. I mean, he made these film clips, like these videos, like, in his living room, just, okay, sit behind this, in front of this green screen, and do, and just hold the guitar and sing the song. And then he puts all these things in there, right? I mean, so this gentleman has a gift beyond just his musical talents. I mean, he really has a gift for just knowing about people and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Is it equally important to have a kind of a muse like that, that can tell you when it's time to maybe take a song out behind the barn and shoot it? You know, sometimes, you know, a producer will help you pull a song out, but sometimes you need that ear to say, hey, Chris, maybe not this one. This isn't working out.
Ever since I started doing this with the folks from Alligator and stuff, I realized that, you know, now there's like more people. I mean, there's more juice. There's like, there's more chance to talk to somebody in an interview and tell them about these tunes or about the record or whatever, that, you know, I can't be so, you know, just like what I say, because there's more people involved. There's more stuff involved. These guys are involved and they're doing all these things to help me to bring these tunes to more people than I've ever had a chance to bring my tunes to, you know? And so,
yeah.
That's when I decided, hey, you know, if they say I should change a verse in this tune, or they say I should do this, you know, I'm not just going to say, no, man, don't tell me what, you know, I'm going to do, at least I'm going to look at it really, really hard and say, okay, you know, I'm not going to say no, you know, because there's more stuff involved now. It's not just me with my little tunes. It's like a bunch of people that are making it do more stuff. And, you know, I mean, I trust them. And so, you know, I think it's just, you know, and I found it in doing that, the thing turned into a bigger, more beautiful thing, because I didn't just keep it all in my, you know, because I probably would have come up with something that would have been small and not reached that many people. But somehow the way he finished that thing up with these other ideas, you know, it was spectacular, man. I, you know, I'll never shut the door like that again, you know?
Yeah. Looking back at it, kind of the early days of your career, you know, I'm always interested when I see a blues guitarist that kind of at least got the professional, you know, introduction to the world. in the 80s, because the landscape of the blues was very different back then.
Oh, man, it was really grim, because, I mean, everywhere I looked or turned on or hear anybody talking, it was like there is no more live music. That's like with DJ or like this. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like some kind of a bad dream that was like it kept on coming on TV and stuff. I'm like, you know what I mean? Like, so you're telling me that you'd rather have a guy with a record player in here than some live music. And I'm thinking about all the things that I've seen as a child, man. I mean, things, live music experiences that were like etched, they're etched in my soul till the day I'm buried, man. It's like fantastic moments on a stage. You know, some of the stuff raw, but I mean, you know, I just couldn't believe that, like, this is what it's going to bubble up to turn into. You know what I mean? All this stuff, all these people. I mean, you know, and see, it made it to the point where, like, then when somebody did look at Ray Charles singing America or something like that, they'd lose their minds. They'd be in tears and stuff. Yeah. And they, you know, and they couldn't figure out why this is kicking their butt so hard. But it's just like emotional stuff that you've seen on stages zillions of times, and people doing this thing that know how to do it, you know, they can change your life with like a tune. It's like you saw this man sing America on TV, you're in tears. I mean, it just changes your whole, I don't know, your whole outlook on the next 25 years or something in a moment, right? And it's like, that's the stuff that for me, you know, I loved about it since I was like 8 years old. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Was some of your contemporaries at that time, like, you know, let's say Robert Cray, obviously Stevie Ray Vaughan, Bonnie Raitt, did that kind of help in some respects, you know, because I look at, you know, what was on the radio, like you said, back in 19.
Oh, no, man,
you know,
definitely. When Johnny Winter came into the picture at that one point, it was a great thing because there were guys that listened to just rock guitar players, and suddenly they're like, wait a minute, this is blues. So then they were checking out Johnny Winter, and then they started checking out like B.B. King and a bunch of people like that. So Johnny Winter, before like Stevie Ray Vaughan opened the door up like that and kind of did it, Johnny Winter did it like at this one point around 1970, that was like a bunch of guys that just were closed off and only played like hard rock guitar said, wait a minute, what'd that guy just say in that thing? You know what I mean? And it would change stuff. And it's like, I saw a guy on TV once say, like, you know, it's like, you watch this Disney cartoon and like all of a sudden the sideway walk opens up and like these ducks come out of this thing playing like, you know, Muskrat Ramble or something. You know what I mean? And you go, well, it's great music. What is that stuff? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, it's Dixieland. Okay. And then, you know, they go and buy a bunch of Dixieland records, but somebody's got to open that, like the cellar door, you know what I mean? Every about like, you know, almost 100 years and like, do something so that people get back and hip to the fact that, just in people, there's stuff, you know, it's, you know what I mean? If you close this thing and you close this door, you're going to miss a lot of stuff because it keeps bubbling up and it does stuff, you know, every so many years. It's like, then you see some new thing, you know, and it's like what came from some old thing, but it just reminds you, this is fantastic. You know, it's like medicine here.
Yeah, it is great to see, you know, a younger group of musicians of the Samantha Fish and the Christone Anderson and some of those guys doing this.
Man, you know what I mean? As soon as you close the door on all that, there it is. That's the future. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it looks good in that respect. Chris, you're going to be coming in to do a show on the 13th of April at the Thunderbird. One of the things I noticed on this record, obviously, you've got some organ, you've got some brass. Are you able to tour with that, or do you kind of use some keyboards to supplement some of that stuff?
Yeah, we just have a four piece, you know, but and see the beautiful thing about those arrangements on those tunes, man. Mike Renta, the gentleman that made these arrangements, he did it on Raising Cane as well. He just went and wrote these arrangements for the tunes, just, and they recorded it just out of love, like the first time. And it was, you know, there could have been like a thing where, you know, you hadn't planned for this and all the ideas that they came up were not something that you heard. And it could be like, oh my God, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was like, there wasn't a note on that Raising Cane record that I would have changed. I mean, he had such a gift for, and on this particular album, While he was writing these charts and recording those parts, his mama was in the hospital dying. And he put all that love into this thing. I mean, I can't say enough about that guy because, man, he has a gift. I mean, just, you know, because the stuff is very personal, and anything that's going to be in the background, you know, it could be, you know, if it was not something you felt, could be like a nightmare to you, you know?
Yeah.
But he has a real gift for that. So yeah, we go out with just the rhythm section. And it's always great whenever I hear those tunes and I hear those arrangements that he put on them. They just make me happy because, I mean, he's another guy that has a gift. You know what I mean?
Mm, absolutely. It would be cool to hear, you know, kind of a different arrangement without them. As cool as it is to hear it with them, it's always fun to hear. I'm one of those people that like to hear songs live that don't sound exactly like the record.
I used to be afraid about like not being able to play it with all the stuff that was on the disc, but it turned into a thing where I like to see what it turns into when it's just the four of us, you know?
Yeah.
This Thunderbird, this place, the first times I went there, it was like kind of like, it was just like, you know, a roadhouse, a really great roadhouse, you know what I mean? And like the fella that runs that place, he's a beautiful guy, man. And, then I went back after not being there for a few years, and it was like it turned it into this beautiful like music hall. I mean, this place is so nice. The way that they deal with the people that play there, it's a gas, man. I mean, that kid, like, and what he did to that place, it's so beautiful. I was hoping we would go there again because I just totally enjoyed the experience of playing for those folks there. And it's nice, really nice.
Yeah. I actually just spoke to Tommy Castro just a couple of weeks ago and said the exact same thing. You know, it was like, you know, there's other places to play, maybe bigger, maybe smaller, maybe newer, you know, whatever. But he wants the character.
When you find one of those on your trip list, you know, it's like you look forward to that because it's like Mother's Arms Plus, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much again. April 13th, you'll be in town to do a show, the new album. Well, not new at this point, but the current album, Good Intentions Gone Bad, a fantastic listen, some great lyrics.
Thank you for having me on. And if you go by there, come and say hello, huh?
Yeah, I'll get you a buy you a tequila that night.
I'll get you one, mister.
All right, sir. Thank you so much, Chris. Appreciate it. Safe travels, man.
Thank you.
All right, Chris Kane, April 13th, which is the night after Brit Floyd. You can turn your attention to the blues at the Thunderbird Cafe and Music Hall and check his show out. His new album is available now. We'll have links in the show notes for both his website, place to get tickets if you want to check out that show. We're going to turn our attention now to an artist that really seems to know no boundaries. I had seen that this gentleman was coming with Dorothy, who many of you are familiar with the style of music, there to Preserving Underground. And I was like, okay, it's a venue that sees a lot of metal. And I was like, this is a country artist, so I need to learn more about this. So I delved in, and I see collaborations with the likes of Sully Erna, Mick Mars, Travis Tritt, Bad Wolves. So we wanted to check out Mr. Corey Marks, an artist that I think combines the beauty that is country in storytelling, but with flares of hard rock and metal and things that would belong on like the Octane channel of Sirius XM, which really made it kind of unique. We've seen artists combine hip hop and country. We've seen obviously pop and country. We've seen the Rolling Stones go blatantly into country music, but Corey kind of takes in a direction that I personally had not heard before, and has a real honesty in the songs, but adds some elements that make it, I think, a little more attractive to an audience such as ours. So I was really delighted to get a chance to talk to him. A great guy. He's a pilot, has his pilot's license, so we get into flying just a tiny bit, and he was an aspiring amateur hockey player. His brother played professional hockey as well, so we get into that as well. But we're gonna play a little bit of Corey Marks. We'll get straight into that.
heavy hitter. I ain't no quitter. I'll go the distance round after round. I know it's up to me.
Corey Marks on the line. How are you doing today, Corey?
John, man, I'm doing great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Got introduced to your music somewhat recently, quite honestly. Delighted to hear what I hear, and you're going to be coming into Pittsburgh doing a really, I think, an amazingly cool bill with Dorothy, which when I checked her music out, I was like, well, this is a really fascinating bill, because you don't get stuff like that where they kind of roll the dice on different styles so drastically. So first off, what kind of drew you to that, to touring with Dorothy? Was that, you know, a booking agent just kind of threw it because of availability, or were you looking to do kind of some different genres in the same night? Was that kind of the idea?
Yeah, well, I've heard of Dorothy now for a few years, and obviously it's been really cool to see, you know, her name and mine in the rock charts over in the U.S. And we have the same agent, and this opportunity came up, and I've worked with, you know, other great, I've toured and had other great female rock artists like Lizzie Hale, Hailstorm, mm-hmm. feature on tracks, and you know, obviously Dorothy's been rocking these you know, rock radio charts, and she's got some cool new music with Slash and of course Scott Stapp of Creed, and this opportunity came up. I think it's a perfect fit. She's got that rock gypsy soul type sound, which I think is really cool, and obviously getting to go out across the U.S. Especially with a great act like Dorothy, you know, I think it's going to be a very cool matchup and a very unique and great you know, rock show for the fans.
Yeah, and personally, I love it, because it's very easy to see, you know, for example, a country artist, you know, you get, I don't want to say cookie cutter, but you get some extremely, like, there's sometimes where you don't, if you close your eyes, you don't differentiate the support acts with the headliner, but you guys really mm-hmm. are giving us, you know, that, you know, growing up, none of us really are probably old enough to remember Woodstock in great detail, but it was so, that's one of the things that was so cool, is you had so many different genres, you know, that really made for a great night, and it exposes your music to an artist who, you know, maybe their atypical fan isn't necessarily noodling around the country charts, but you know, they may recognize your name from the rock charts, so I think it's an excellent idea. Your music I found incredibly interesting, because I think, you know, I think Shania Twain, in some respects, kicked the door open for allowing country to kind of blend into other genres of music. You know, some of us grew up in the era of Randy Travis and Conway Twitty, and country was country.
Great era.
Yeah, absolutely a great era, but not a lot of crossover. And then, you know, other than, dare I say, the Rolling Stones really did a nice job of kind of infusing country into their rock. But you kind of take this in, I want to say, almost a metal direction. You know, I'm listening to some of this going, this could be on like Turbo on Sirius, or this could be on Chris Stapleton's mm-hmm. station. And then, you know, in researching this, I see, you know, Ozzy Osbourne and Rush and your influences right there next to Merle Haggard. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of like take me through, you know, what was in your car stereo when you were growing up?
Well, I was really lucky to grow up with a variety of great music, and you know, I do think that, you know, those were some really great times, and obviously before I was born, but that's what I listened to. You know, my dad being from Toronto, mm-hmm. you know, I grew up, and I was a drummer before any of this, so I grew up on a lot of those great rock bands, of course, Rush, but there's Deep Purple, Grand Funk Railroad, you know, Ozzy Osbourne, Bryan Adams, but you know, my dad was also in a country western band in his early 20s, and his brother, Wolf Milestone, is still a country singer. And so in the house and in the car, you know, and with family gatherings and mom being from a small little farm town in northern Ontario, Canada, basically between where I was born in North Bay and halfway to where Shania Twain's from, ironically, up in Timmins. So, you know, there was a lot of Merle Haggard, George Jones, Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, even the older stuff, like, you know, getting into, you know, there's of course Buck Owens and the Bakersfield sound, but, you know, the Carter family, and I'm a huge fan of Jimmy Rodgers, you know, really the kind of the foundation of country music, if you will. But then there was, of course, guys like Travis Tritt too, that were out there, and absolutely, you know, it's incredible to be able to call him a friend now. And, you know, I get a Christmas card from the Tritt family every year. And, you know, we get to play some shows together and have them on some songs. So it's been really, really a whirlwind. But, you know, I grew up on all that great stuff, the country and rock that I mentioned. But when my teens, I progressed a little bit into obviously expanding from Rush into music like Dream Theater, and then into like Pantera, Lamb of God. So I've had a great, you know, connection with all that music. And it's really music that I really do love, whether because of the drums or guitar sections or just the, in the country world, especially the story that the song is telling, you know, and the heart and emotion that goes behind it. So when I became, you know, when I really took the songwriting and being an artist seriously back in 2011 or whatever it was, I've always just dreamt of having that sound where I could mix these genres together to make it my own. Yeah. And that's, you know, great country music and rock that I grew up on. And I find the best way I describe my sound is, you know, so there's quite a few mixes, but it'd be like mixing up Merle Haggard, Eric Church, Brian Adams, and Ozzy Osbourne. You put them all kind of together, and that's really kind of that's my sound. And that's, again, that's just something I think is unique and hasn't been quite done. And I just really enjoyed it. I really enjoy the writing and the recording, and it seems to be working out so far. So that's how I kind of came up with that sound.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I think it's that's what's kind of interesting is this is sort of an infusion of sounds that I can't say. And I listen, admittedly, and this might get me kicked off my own show, but I listen to a lot of country music and you know, I listen to a lot of metal. You know, your Panteras and your Dream Theaters are right up my alley too. But, you know, I don't know that I've heard anybody kind of blend some of that. You know, when I listen to, you know, you and Sully Erna and, you know, Travis, and it blends so seamlessly, you know, it's, you know, you think, okay, this is going to sound weird, but it doesn't. And that's really, really cool. But then the other thing that I like is that you explore different sounds. This isn't just Godsmack country. You've got country, country, you've got stuff that's a little heavier. One track in particular that I kind of racked my brains going through the lyrics, 1949. Can you kind of walk through that particular song? Because it had me scratching. I was trying to do the math. Was this a love story about your parents, or was this maybe grandparents, or was it really about a truck? Yeah. You know, was this Red Barchetta part two?
Kind of, you know, the country Red Barchetta. Yeah, that's very nice. No, that song is really, it's a very special song. That I wrote with my grandfather in mind, and I wrote it with my good buddy Craig Brooks, who'd lost his father, and we were kind of on that topic, and we're talking old trucks, and you know, it's really just a life story of time, you know, through, and we kind of, you know, his dad had this old pickup truck, and so did my grandfather, my pater, as we call him in French, and the special thing was my mom's dad, my pater. My mom's a baby of eight, and I'm, out of all my cousins, I was the last one born. I always say out of the litter. So there's quite a few of us. I mean, I have cousins that are, you know, 20 years older than me, because it's such a big family. However, I was born on the same day as my papa, so they call us the evil twins. Yeah, we were born the same day, 65 years apart, October 11th, which is Thanksgiving up here in Canada, right? So a lot of my years growing up, I spent with him at where my mom was kind of in the old town where my mom's from, and that's where, you know, we'd have the back then, of course, you know, you got the beer bottles and cigarette smoke in the kitchen with guitars and fiddles, right?
Yeah.
And it was always just a big celebratory weekend. So, with him in mind, you know, he's kind of like the old guy in the truck, you know, and I kind of went back on him and my my grandmother, you know, and how they met. And it's just a kind of a bit of a walk through life, through, like, it's not the eyes, but through this truck that eventually gets restored, you know, and given to this kid, because he actually gave it to my cousin, this old truck that he had. And so it's kind of, you know, it's a really special song. It's close to both, obviously, Craig's and mine, you know, our hearts. It's a bit of an homage to two very special people in our lives, and that being his father, who's passed on, and the same with my grandfather. So, yeah. And I mean, that's one of those, that's the whole, you know, when I mentioned the country storytelling, yeah. I think it kind of says it all right there in that track, 1949.
Yeah, and that's such a universal theme, you know, when you listen to that, that I think that's good. That song,
I appreciate
you,
that.
You know, touch a lot of people, and I think it kind of jumped off the album to me, and it showed,
well,
you know, like you said, the storyteller that tends to be, you know, kind of a theme with country music, not always, but can you talk?
Yeah,
you've had some really awesome guests on your records, you know, Mick Mars, Travis Tritt, you mentioned Sully Erna from Godsmack. Can you talk a little bit? I mean, how do you go about? Is this, you know, producer may know somebody, or they're in the same studio, same label, same management group? How do you go about kind of getting all these guys? And was anybody kind of a tough sell? Like, did you have to kind of like coax Mick Mars into playing on, quote, a country album? Or
Mick was probably the easiest. I mean, at first it definitely happened with connections. I mean, my producer, Kevin Churko, is obviously, you know, I've made a lot of great hit records and singles with Five Finger Death Punch. I'm the only country artist on a rock, hard rock metal label, that being better known.
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, Motley Crue was on that label as well. So that was one of those label producer connections. But as, you know, as time rolled on, in this most recent track, at the time when we wrote Make My Country Rock, I thought, this is really a story about who I am and what, you know, what I envision when it comes to my music. And, you know, it was kind of like it was going to be around the 5-year mark of Outlaws and Outsiders. So my original plan was to get the boys back together. Right. And, I was in town in Nashville when I wrote that song, and I texted Mick, and I went over to Mick's. I got to go to Mick's house and hang out with Mick, and I was actually one of the first people to hear his solo record before it came out. And so I'm sitting as, you know, we're just sitting in his studio, and he asked if I had anything that I wrote this week that I could show him. And of course, I actually had this demo of Make My Country Rock. I said, look, it's just a demo, but, you know, let me know what you think. So I showed it to him, and he just kind of looks at it and goes, man, that's another kick-ass song. And I said, well, listen, I'm going to have to ask, because our idea was kind of the new age Outlaws and Outsiders, the 5-year, you know, would you be interested in playing on it? And he said, absolutely, not a problem. I think it kicks ass. So let's give me a week, and I'll put some guitars on it, and you let me know what you want, kind of thing. So there we had Mick. And then when we decided we need another feature, I said, well, I got to talk to Travis, because if it's going to be Make My Country Rock, I need a country artist. And he's the first on my call list. So I was touring across Canada in February last year, and had a great conversation with Travis, and he basically, you know, said he loved the song, and you know, of course, with his thick accent, he says, well, man, it, you know, did pretty damn good last time, so why don't we do it again? I said, all right, man. So I got Travis and Mick, and I said, I gotta call Ivan and see what's going on. But you know, unfortunately, he was actually, I mean, it was great for him, but he was, you know, they were in Germany touring with Metallica, so we couldn't get him in the studio, and he loved the song, but we just couldn't make it work. So some other names came up, and when I heard Sully Erna, I thought to myself, man, I grew up on Godsmack, you know, of course, in the hockey room and getting ready for big games. You know, he had Godsmack, and I knew he was a big Rush fan, so there's a connection there. And we're both front men who do drum solos during our shows. So I said, you know, he was on that list. I said, he's the number one. If we can get him, you know, that would be incredible. And about a week after that, I get a text on my phone that says, maybe Sully Erna. I didn't even know he had accepted yet. I didn't even know he was – And he, you know, it was a big, beautiful message. Just thanks for having me on this track. I think it's going to be massive for you. I love the song. And he ended it with, hell, I think I might even love this song more than you do. You know, give me a holler if you need anything kind of thing. And thanks again. And so I kind of went to my team, like, so I guess Solly's on it. And they sent me the track. And I thought, holy shit, this is the one. And that's how that song came together with those features. So it's pretty cool.
Now, does this kind of put some pressure on you, you know, when you go to make the next album, like, how am I going to outdo this combination? Or do you go back to the well of, you know, you've got some proven, you know, kind of ingredients to sprinkle in there, or do you go in a totally different direction next time?
Well, I mean, I always, that's the challenge as an artist, is you're always trying to make, you know, up the last one and keep growing, right, and keep building. But I think, you know, what I kind of tell myself to, you know, I kind of told myself since the get-go, listen, not only are you technically a country act, you're a Canadian country act making waves across the U.S. and, you know, over in Europe and Germany. And you know, so it's like, okay, we're moving, you know, I think we're moving the needle and doing our thing pretty well so far. And so I try not to put too much pressure and really just, you know, write what I know and what I want. I know that people are going to relate to and hope that they love the next song, the next album, as much as the first one, or if not more. So there's always a little bit of pressure there. I'm pretty hard on myself and trying to make something great, you know, and hopefully that's the way the listeners hear it and see it, whether they're country fans, rock fans, and like sure. I said, even metal fans.
So when you write, I mean, you've just had a chance to speak to Russ Ballard recently, you know, one of the greatest songwriters ever, who, you know, talked about sitting at a piano. When you write, do you tend to use, dare I say, acoustic guitar, electric guitar? I mean, what's your primary kind of muse when it comes to fleshing out ideas?
For me, it's just all about emotion. I mean, I've written songs on napkins in a plane. You know, I hum to my phone so I don't forget the melody. And obviously in a plane, you got to hum pretty loud so your phone can catch it. Like there's a song on my first record called Drive. I literally wrote that. I had this idea coming back from a video shoot in Vancouver, BC. Okay. And I had, you know, 5 or 6 hour red eye flight. Couldn't sleep, but I had this melody stuck in my head. And I was actually kind of just going over those couple days shooting a music video, kind of putting this love interest and love story together of like a what if scenario, you know. Right. And you know, that's just an example. I mean, there's songs like on this new record, for example, Late Night of Drinking Again, where, you know, I just had Haggard in mind, and I was going through some stuff at the time, and that's one of those songs that, you know, picked up the guitar and literally just said, it's a late night of drinking again, you know, and I just went, oh, hey, that's something Merle would do. And that was one of those songs that took 20 minutes. You know, yeah. I just wrote it. I'm like, I'm not changing a thing. This is how this song's supposed to be.
Right.
I mean, there's always the production side of things.
Sure.
And Kevin Churko was so incredible at that. Again, going back to the song Drive, the melody and everything was how I had envisioned it. But when I sent it to him, when I did the acoustic demo, and then he sent back the layout of the song, he had changed it to that really cool, you know, the heavier guitars,
right,
which kind of caught me off guard at first. But it was just, I just thought it was so well done. And, you know, he really, I mean, that's what a great producer does. I've always said he's the master of taking a good song and making it great.
Yeah, I mean, and he's worked with, looking at his bio, everyone from the aforementioned Shania Twain through Disturbed and Ozzy himself. I mean, it's amazing what a producer, you know, with that skill set of putting the song first, you know, genre almost falls to the side. You mentioned
like a whole other band member.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned humming out the melody of a song in a plane. Dare I ask, were you flying when you did that? Because you got to be paying attention.
Yeah, no, that certainly happened. But I wasn't flying this one. This one was I was a passenger.
Okay.
But I do think of some ideas even when I'm flying. But typically, yeah, when I'm flying, I'm pretty focused on keeping the airplane airborne and flying well until I'm ready to bring it back down and land.
Yeah, I as you were saying that, I was thinking of was it Learning to Fly from Pink Floyd, which I often wonder, you know, was somebody in the cockpit when they wrote that song? Because it's such a, you know, the
right
imagery that they paint with the lyrics is so amazing on that. So that's excellent. And you played a little hockey. Your brother, if I'm not mistaken, played a little hockey. So mm-hmm. that was there a point where you kind of said, "Hey, yeah. you know, I got to hang up the skates. It's time to pick up the guitar." Or had you been playing? You know, doing both kind of all along.
It kind of went hand in hand. I mean, I still actually play every now and then when I can. I know friends always like to have me on their team during tournaments, but they don't really know my schedule, and quite frankly, neither do I when it comes to touring and stuff. It can just pop up. So, my life was really a bit of a roller coaster when it came to picking something. I mean, I was on skates. My brother and I. I mean, we grew up in a big hockey family. We were on skates since we were 3 years old, and I played hockey all the way up to, you know, junior, major, junior, and into the university. I had mm-hmm. an opportunity to play for the Buckeyes, Division I in Ohio State, but I, at 18 years old, fresh out of high school, I didn't want to go back to school, so yeah. I had a full ride option and opportunity, and some friends, you know, go like, as if you said no to that, you know, but I mean, here I am now, but
yeah, it seemed to work out.
It's a big part of my life. Yeah, we're still chugging along and working hard. But yeah, I think I'm hoping things will. You know, I'm hoping I made the right decision. But
yeah, I'm curious how mom and dad took the news when you said no to Ohio State.
You know what? My dad's always, you know, my dad's always taught us to do what we love and love what we do. And my brother and I worked really hard at whatever we wanted to do. And they're just very proud and happy that we're both doing, you know, something we love. Like, my brother retired from professional hockey. He was drafted to the NHL and retired from professional hockey not quite 4 years ago, but he's been coaching. He was a Seattle Thunderbirds assistant coach for 3 years. And for the first time in 21 years, he's actually back home coaching our OHL battalion, major awesome. Junior hockey team, assistant coach here. So he's back home after 21 years, but still very much involved in the game. And yeah, you know, I'm still out on the road and recording albums and doing my thing. So it's been a lot of fun.
The irony with your music, you'll be playing a lot of hockey arenas, I dare to say, in the future. So, cool.
Well, the ones that I have played, I do let people know that, you know, typically the stages, right? Depending if it's a half arena, you know, you're kind of stages set up in the center ice or back in the goal crease. But I said, it's nice to be here for so long because I spent most of my time in the penalty boxes.
Put your teeth back in, get back out there. But Corey, I want to thank you so much. You'll be here at Preserving Underground with Dorothy on the 21st. And as I said, it's not going to be long before you're going to be in much, much bigger venues. For those who get a chance to see this, this is going to be a limited time to see you in this venue. So pleasure talking with you. Wish you all the best.
That,
and we'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
Yeah, man. I look forward to it. I hope to see you at the show. And it's going to be good to be back in Pittsburgh, where I got engaged last year at a Bryan Adams concert in Pittsburgh. So
awesome.
I'm sure it'll be really cool to be back there. And you know,
good,
this time
good memories.
I get to play the show. So it'll be
awesome.
Good. Yeah, man. Absolutely.
All right, again, that was Corey Marks. He's coming to Pittsburgh on Monday, April 21st to play Preserving Underground. Technically New Ken, but if you're from Pittsburgh, you know that already. That is going to be in support of Dorothy. So I think a really, really cool bill. Love to see when bands on a bill don't play the exact same kind of music. I think everyone's been to a show in their lives where after about 4 hours of bands that sound the same, even the best bands can get a little boring. Love the fact that this show is going to have a yin and a yang. Two very different, but similar. There's a common DNA, I think, there. You know, when you've got an artist who sings country saying they're influenced by Dimebag and Ozzy Osbourne, you got to take a listen to that. So I hope you enjoyed it. You can find out more information, tickets at IronCityRocks.com for all the shows we mentioned. Britt Floyd on the 11th and 12th, Chris Kane on the 13th, Corey Marks on the 21st. You can find information on all those at ironcityrocks.com. All of our social medias are Iron City Rocks. No spaces, no dashes, no dots, no underscores. Keep an eye on it. We'll be giving lots of tickets away to some amazing shows over the next few months. They're really starting to ramp up here in Pittsburgh. The first few months of the year are always a little bit slow, a little sluggish for touring, and then like the daffodils, they just fly out around this time of year, so it's great to see. You can drop us an email, ironcityrocks@gmail.com. Love to hear from you. And until next time, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen.